Good morning. I'd like to welcome you to session 201, The Crisis of Mormon Intellectuals, How to Believe When You Don't Think You Can. Our presenter this morning is Michael Vinson, who has just received a master's degree from the Divinity School at the University of Cambridge and is the author of Sunstone's Scripture Notes column. He has two previous master's degrees and just 2 days ago had his first solo airplane flight. He also is a self-employed dealer with items relating to the American West, particularly old and rare books, and appeared as an appraiser on the first season of Antiques Roadshow in that regard. So definitely authority, and welcome, Sir Vincent.
An authority in some areas, but definitely not in this one. I originally encompassed this talk to think of three crises that Mormon intellectuals would face. And intellectual would be very broadly defined as anybody who is engaged and thinking critically in small c, not the large c, about their religion. And with that term, everybody in this room is an intellectual. And the three crises that have seemed to me that occurred to people, the first one is one of doubt and faith. The idea that when facts, something that you learn about the church or about its doctrine, comes into conflict with something else that you learn, some evidence. The second crisis would be that of the problem of an all-knowing and all-loving God and evil in the world, often called the problem of theodicy, would be what I would consider to be the second crisis. And the third crisis would be the problem of how to speak critically to power in the church. I'm not going to deal with the other two today, because as I wrote this thing, I ended up with like 50 pages. So I decided to just deal with the first one today. Hopefully in subsequent opportunities, I'll deal with the other two crises. But the crisis that I wanted to deal with today is that of faith and doubt. What I would like to do this morning is to show you that without a raging torrent of doubt in your minds, your faith is actually incomplete. In particular, I would like to speak about why the church now, especially now, needs intellectual Mormons more than ever. This, even though the most prevalent attitude of Latter-day Saints is a fundamentalist outlook, that is to say the least, not favorable to intellectual viewpoints. One Sunday, you find yourself sitting in sacrament meeting and thinking, what am I doing here? Perhaps the speaker is aligning her right-wing political views and testimony as if it were a perfect match, or perhaps he is rehashing the official view of some episode of church history, highlighting the miraculous intervention of the Lord's hand, while you sit there like a weasel in the Lord's hen house, with doubts and skeptical thoughts raging through your mind. One of the most troublesome aspects of modern church meetings, at least for those with doubts, is testimony meeting, and particularly the statement of those who know various things about the church, the Book of Mormon, Joseph Smith, and the gospel. The first problem that occurs to me about this is the binary choice that's implied here. Either you know or you don't know. There's no in-between setting. You can't be like, partial know, partial don't care, or partial know, partial don't believe. It's either or. Anyone with even a twinge of doubt about church history, politics, or doctrines naturally feels uncomfortable with such declarations of pure knowledge. With a raging torrent of doubt coursing through you and with no one to speak to about this, aside perhaps from the Sunstone Borderlands columns of Jeff Burton, you may very well feel more comfortable absenting yourself from church meetings. In spite of the anti-intellectual attitudes that are present in the church, we should not dismiss so easily the appeal of a fundamentalism to most people. A fundamentalist outlook provides safe answers to the difficult problems of the scary world that we wake up to every morning. The assurance of an all-powerful, all-loving God who has a plan for your life and your church, when the world around you seems to be falling to pieces, can be a real comfort to those who feel socially oppressed and scared of everything that's happening. But there are real hazards in belonging to a religious institution with a fundamentalist definition of faith. One is that of orthodoxy, the inability of the institution to tolerate any other forms of faith or belief. This is the real danger of a dogmatic and fundamentalist faith that believes it has all the answers and does not tolerate any doubt. The members of such a church have few places within or without to honestly discuss their own concerns, troubles, and doubts. And they have little or no room, those within the church, for those who do struggle with doubt. Secondly, fundamentalists often bury many of their own doubts. And those suppressed doubts may emerge in several different ways. For example, as a fanatical adherence to congregational rules, or as an intolerance of those who do not observe the rules with the same intensity that they do. Paul Tillich, a noted theologian, said in this regard, "In those who rest upon their unshakable faith, fanaticism is the unmistakable symptom of doubt which has been suppressed. Doubt is not overcome by suppression, but by courage. Courage does not deny there is doubt, but takes the doubt into itself as an expression of its own finitude. Courage does not need the safety of an unquestionable conviction." Tillich believed that if church authorities of any religion with enforcement power over its subjects tried to regulate spiritual conformity, they will remove the risk and courage that belong to faith. Regulation of spiritual authority. Sound familiar? And fanaticism, even or especially in religious service, is only a form of false belief that is grounded in one's pride about being chosen and selected above others. In other words, the denial of doubt can be part of the pretense of a testimony, and the suppression of those who only partially believe does nothing to build faith in the ward or the congregation. Let's go back to those declarations of knowing in the testimony meeting that I mentioned earlier. Did you know they actually violate the first principle of the gospel? Hang with me for a moment. I have a point to make. You will acknowledge, as any church leader would, that the first principle of the gospel is faith, and faith by scriptural definition is not a knowing. Some of you will recognize the proposition I am stating has a Mormon version of the classical theological statement of fideism. To restate it more formally, Mormon theology teaches that we are saved by following the four principles of the gospel that we all know: faith, repentance, baptism, and the Holy Ghost. The first of these, faith, can be defined as trust in the empirically unprovable. This definition fits nicely with the scriptural definition given by Alma and Paul, if you believe that Paul wrote Hebrews. "For if a man knoweth a thing, he hath no cause to believe." Faith is defined as the hoping for of things unseen, not the knowing of the unseen. So if the truthfulness of the plan of salvation in the church can be known, then faith in the gospel is unnecessary. Therefore, if it is true we must have faith in the gospel, there can be no proof of the truthfulness of the gospel. Well, what occurs to me is there's an awful lot of the violation of the first principle of the gospel going on in testimony meeting. Let's consider for a moment the implications of denying doubt in faith, or to put it another way, to confuse knowledge with faith. Carl Jung pointed out that one of the major crises to face 20th century man was the isolation of faith because of knowledge. In Jung's words, "Our denominational religions, with their archaic rites and conceptions, justified enough in themselves, express a view of the world which caused no great difficulties in the Middle Ages, but has become strange and unintelligible to modern man." Jung is talking about the conflict between a scientific worldview and a religious belief. His larger point is that the rupture between faith and knowledge in our day is a symptom of the split consciousness that is so characteristic of mental disorders. Jung believed that this was because church ministers preached that their faith is supported by biblical fact, which provide empirical evidence for their religious beliefs. If you think of your first and earliest experiences, what I want to go to now is sort of talk about the idea that we can pray for knowledge, because that has to be confronted as part of this as well. We can't shy away from it or shove it under a box. It's part of what is preached here. If you think of your first and earliest experiences within your religious tradition, for most of you it'll be Mormonism, there was probably at some point in which you had an emotional and spiritual experience that lent credibility to your beliefs, or at least you thought they did. You may even have believed that your experience confirmed the truth of your religious tradition for you. It was only later, in the confrontation between your faith and knowledge, that you began to abandon your faith or to doubt it. You're not alone in this. 200 years ago, a religious philosopher named Friedrich Schleiermacher had the same experience. In 1786, he had an experience with Jesus that he believed Jesus, you know, he was converted and saved. But then when he went to college, he was a very young man at the time, but when he went to college, he abandoned the faith that he had. And he gave it up entirely. After abandoning that faith, his father disowned him and said, you know, if you don't believe the atonement comes through Jesus, I can have no part of you in our family. But Schleiermacher later came to embrace that spiritual experience that he had, but defined it differently. And I'll talk about that later on. But John Hick, a modern religious philosopher, had something very similar happen to him. John Hick, a 20th century religious philosopher, as a young man, had a spiritual experience, very intense, in his, I think he was at University College in Hull, and England. And when he had that experience, he was converted to evangelical. He became an evangelical. But later, he began to wonder whether that experience was really proof of the evangelical belief that he was studying at the time, or whether it might be something else. So just keep that in mind, that sometimes just because you have a spiritual experience, it's not necessarily defining what you might think it is. The knowledge that challenged your testimony may have been any of the numerous biblical stories and myths that have fallen to the facts of science, from the fossil evidence of the evolution of mankind against the creation story of Adam and Eve to the impossibility of the universal flood. As each biblical fact falls in the face of scientific evidence, it becomes more difficult to continue the faith and testimony needed for the next level of belief. Jung believed that the fundamental problem here was that most church leaders reject any tendency to consider the ancient assertions of the Bible as written metaphors, and consequently to try to understand them symbolically. Instead, they take it as a biblical fact of some kind. You might say, now we'll get to it. What about the admonitions of Moroni to pray and find out for yourself an alma to plant the seed of faith and watch it grow? Most would claim that these are experimental techniques that can lead to spiritual knowledge. How does that fit into the requirement for faith? I would say, against those who claim that this is knowledge, that it fails two crucial tests. First, it cannot be consistently replicated in experimental form. You will agree that each individual experience will differ according to factors that we have no control, including the will of God. The second test is it cannot be given to others. You can tell others what you have learned or gained, but you cannot pass it to them or give them some test to guarantee that they have received it. In other words, it's a highly personal and subjective spiritual experience between you and God. I'm not denying the experience. I'm just saying that what we think of, the way that we normally think of that experience, asking us to think differently about it, it's subject to your own feelings and, yes, to your own doubts as well. What is needed is a belief system that both recognizes the validity of these personal spiritual experiences, but that can also encompass all of our doubts and our criticisms. We need a new definition of faith, one that is inclusive of doubt, and recognizes and embraces those insecurities and unknowns that form part of every religion. So what is a doubt-struggling intellectual to do? Paul Tillich proposed a model of faith that might be applicable for some people. Tillich proposed that we consider faith as the embracing of something of ultimate concern for the individual. Something immeasurable that transcends this life is precisely of what is ultimate concern. Tillich said it better than I can. Faith cannot be shaken by historical research, even if its results are critical of the traditions in which the event is reported. This liberates the faithful from a burden they cannot carry after the demands of scholarly honesty have shaped their conscience. Think about that for a minute. This liberates the faithful from the demands of a scholarly honesty which has shaped their conscience. Faith is not dictated by knowledge. What I said earlier, what applies on the one side to it applies on the other as well. The bad things, the bad knowledge, you know, yeah, we're not finding any biblical knowledge or facts here, but the bad facts and criticism also shouldn't affect your faith as well. Remember, faith is not knowledge, and especially not a knowledge of facts, good or bad, or of degrees of evidence. Tillich was careful not to consider a belief system as one of faith that was only defined as a degree of knowledge with a low threshold of evidence. In other words, a false faith in Tillich's model is one which is considered on a scale of knowing, but which has not yet acquired the degree of evidence needed for full knowledge. This is the faith of fanatical fundamentalism, which often masquerades as a testimony based on knowledge in the church. What we are calling for here is a new definition of faith, because if faith is only understood as a belief that something is true, then any doubt is incompatible with that faith. But if faith is the embracing of a belief that overwhelms us, even or especially if we do not understand why it should do so, then doubt is a necessary element and a partner in that faith. Because by its very nature, we do not know why we are encompassed by this belief, only that we are. And you wonder why, in spite of your doubts, you still feel close ties to those in your ward and even to the church, warts and all. Now you know it is the encompassing of the unknown, those doubts and musings, with the relationship of those whom you know and love. Let me clarify for a moment what I mean by doubt. I do not mean a deductive doubt that in its skepticism has the attitude of rejecting any certainty at all. A deductive doubt is one based on mathematical or logical reasoning. But those formal statements with no grounding in real life and experience are likely to lead only to cynicism. the inability to believe anything, and ultimately despair in your personal life. This doubt is fed by pride and is incapable of love except for self-love. Then it becomes a form of narcissism and is incapable of seeing anything beyond itself. Neither is the doubt that I'm talking about here part of a scientific doubt based on rational experiments and empirical evidence. This is scientific reasoning, motivated from doubt, but seeking only evidence in the physical world. But religious belief is not based on experimental evidences. If you could have physical proofs, you would have no need of faith. Tillich is not the only intellectual who advocates this need to embrace this point of view on faith. Jung also believed modern man needed to embrace his historical religious beliefs in spite of his worldly scientific knowledge. In Jung's words, there is, however, a strong empirical reason why we should hold beliefs that we know can never be proved. Jung advocated those beliefs because they were known to be useful, because we need ideas and convictions in our lives that give meaning and enable us to locate ourselves in the universe. Jung concluded it is the purpose and endeavor of these non-provable religious symbols to give higher purpose to the life of man. Consider this further about your knowledge of doctrinal errors and historical mistakes in the church. Soteriological claims that require faith by their very nature cannot be proven by history or archaeology. That salvation for Mormons comes through Jesus Christ and the Book of Mormon cannot be proved by any historical fact, regardless of the Hellenistic context of the New Testament or the archaeological vocabulary of the Book of Mormon. Even if you were to find some inscription in a Mayan stone that said, Nephi was here. It'd be worth a lot of money, by the way. I know a church that might buy it. Even if you were to find that, it does nothing toward proving salvation for you in the church. Our search for these evidences can easily become idolatrous when the material thing of evidence becomes of more importance than the hierophantic event of belief. None of the saving claims about the church can be proven through history, archaeology, or artifacts. In summary, there is no factual knowledge in the realm of religious salvation that will ultimately save you. Remember, the main temptation of Christ was a temptation to a skeptical doubt, a doubt that was posed to cause him to despair about his call and purpose. But even though Jesus had his doubts sometimes, think of his anguished cry, for example, on the cross for the Father when he felt abandoned. He ultimately embraced the doubt within the life he led. You are encompassed by this belief which embraces and accepts your doubts and criticisms exactly because it is not a knowledge that something is true and in spite of your historical and doctrinal knowledge of errors and mistakes. Yes, you may only have a fragment of belief that you think ties you to your faith community in the ward or wherever, but that fragment of belief is actually a form of epistemological humility against fundamentalists who delight in declarations of knowledge. You bear humble witness of the not knowing, perhaps even doubting, but still desiring to believe school. Perhaps in the past you have thought with your doubts it would be better to stay away from your ward. But I hope you have seen this morning that you have more in common with Jesus and the Mormon Church than you ever thought possible. After all, if the Lord wanted a historically based church, he could just give the golden plates and put them on display down in Salt Lake City. That would prove it once and for all. There they are, for everyone to see. But he doesn't provide proofs, and therein lies our confrontation with our doubts, and if we choose it, our salvation, in faith that encompasses our disbelief. Your ability to embrace both doubt and faith has a parallel in quantum mechanics, the spooky effect, as Einstein called it, in a subatomic world. Consider the theory of superposition, in which matter occupies two states simultaneously. There is no either-or gate for faith or doubt, for knowledge or not knowledge, as we are used to thinking. In superpositional Mormon theology, faith and doubt simultaneously occupy the same space. This simultaneous possession of both faith and doubt within our beliefs and thoughts is not so novel as it seems. It is only our adherence to an incoherent theological position that has led us astray. After all, in the Gospel of Mark, we read of one ancient believer forced to recognize his doubt upon the declaration of his own testimony at the very same time. And straightway, the father of the child cried out with tears, Lord, I believe. Help thou mine unbelief. It is my prayer that you embrace both your doubt and belief and find for yourself a place in the congregation. Thank you.
Thank you very much. That was meaty food for thought.
I have, if you want to put an email address at the front, I'd be happy to send a PDF to anyone that would like one.
Thank you. Quite a way to start a gospel doctrine class, I would say. We have about 10 minutes for questions, so I encourage you to ask your questions, and we'll have wise answers.
You'll have made-up answers. I do teach gospel doctrine every third Sunday if anybody wants to come up to Star Valley and sit in on the class. I was supposed to teach this coming Sunday, but my grandbaby's getting blessed. And I passed it off to the guy, and I said, you know, this is where we're talking now about the change of the church to embrace the Greeks so that they didn't have to become Jews. I said, but you should ask the class this, that if Jesus taught with the disciples for 40 days and 40 nights, why didn't he tell them that the law of Moses was fulfilled? There we go. But he didn't seem to want to talk about that. All right. Questions or comments? Be happy to welcome any. Go ahead.
Yeah, I just had a comment and a question. When you were talking about the first principle of the gospel and people giving up and bearing their testimony, I know this is true, I know that is true. It feels really good to be certain about things and to fill that purpose need, that sense of purpose that we all want. So I guess my question is, when people have those spiritual experiences, do you think that they're like more of a transcendent experience or even mysticism, or are they in fact like from God?
What do you think? What the question is, when a person has a spiritual experience, is it a mystical experience, a transcendent experience, or is it actually from God? I'll just throw it back to you. What do you think?
You know, that's a tough question to answer. I would say, I think it's more transcendent. I mean, everybody wants that sense of purpose. Everybody wants to feel like they know what life is all about. And the answer can come in so many different ways to so many different people, and it's really not clear cut. I mean, who's to say that an answer that comes to a Muslim or a Jew or a Christian are not from God? I mean, I think that if they are transcendent, is that ultimately from God?
It seems a little narrow to believe that God might speak to only one church and members of one church. If you imagine yourself, if you can, as God, as a parent, loving all of your children, no matter who they are, embracing all of them, it seems a little difficult that you would only speak to one particular group. But I do, if you're curious, I absolutely do believe in Jesus. I believe that he can communicate with us. But I believe he can communicate with anybody that desires to. Any next question or comment? Go ahead.
You say that God doesn't provide proof, and that if he wanted to prove it, he would show us the gold plates and put them in jams and something. But the proofs that are offered in the Book of Mormon are feelings, which of course nobody can prove or replicate. My question is, if he doesn't provide proof, and he doesn't want us to know, why do we have the Book of Abraham, the scrolls, that prove otherwise? Or tend to prove otherwise.
All right. So if I understand your question or your comment correctly, your thought is that there's an evidence that was provided in the scrolls of the Book of Abraham, for example, and that because we have the scrolls, that's proof of some aspect of the gospel. Is that understanding? Oh, no. Let's let her have her say, everybody. Let's be fair here. I want to be fair. Do I understand correctly? Is that what you were saying?
Yeah, you said he doesn't...
Just say yes or no. It's a yes or no question. All right. I just want to make sure I understand you correctly. There are people that would say that that's not a proof. And those are people who have actually interpreted and can have read the existing manuscripts that still exist. None of the existing manuscripts actually say anything like what we have in the Book of Abraham. I personally, by the way, tend to believe that if we were to have the golden plates come up in front of us, they wouldn't say anything like what the Book of Mormon reads. But I do think that it was probably the motivation for a revelation for Joseph Smith. And just as the scrolls apparently were a motivation for a revelation at that point. And then whether or not you believe in that revelation, that comes down to your faith. But that's all, in my opinion. Go ahead.
I think part of the problem sometimes has to do with just the phrase "I know," and then sloppy with the language that the word "know," where when it shows up in the text, it's rooted in a particular context and particular time and particular language. So do you think part of the problem is, on one hand, it's sloppy use where when someone says "I know," that might be merely a code for to say, "I feel strongly about," or "I'm compelled to believe." So there's that side. Or when that word shows up, let's say, in a translation from the Old Testament, that we take the Hebrew word, translate it into the English, 20th century English, and then we code it differently. Do you think that's part of the problem, that a testimony meeting in particular, that it's a shorthand way, but because it's a shorthand way that suggests what you believe, that it's not misguided, but an incomplete way to express that?
Well, that might be one way of looking at it. When you think people are using that shorthand in testimony meeting, what do you think they're actually saying?
Is it a direct question or a rhetorical
question? I'm asking you.
Well, I don't know.
This is like Sunstone Sunday School. You're on the spot, man. If you raise your hand in this class, you are dead meat.
Well, I don't know, and I would say that's the problem. It may mean for that person, I am absolutely dead certain.
Right. I think for most people it does. For most people, that's how, when they say "I know," that's what they think it means.
But maybe, right? We don't know, and I think that's part of the problem.
Well,
right.
I think for most people to get up and say that, they absolutely do think they know with all of their heart.
But
and
just
I think,
know in what sense? Part of
well, if you were to ask them, you could ask them, do you
what
actually
about
believe this is true?
The 10-year-old or the 12-year-old or the 8-year-old that says it's hot.
They probably do absolutely think that they know at that age,
or
even though they're just saying it. But whether or not they actually do is up to them entirely. It's not a question that we can answer. But what we can answer are the questions about ourselves, and what you can answer are the questions about yourself. What do you think you mean when you say that? That's really the only question that we can drive at here. We had several comments. Let's take them from around here.
Can you summarize for the tape as well? Summarize the question.
Okay.
I grew up in Starville, and there must be something in the water that makes you ask questions.
Yeah, well, Bill Call lives in Starville too.
The Greeks said there were four ways of knowing. What we're talking about is, in my opinion, characterized by a misunderstanding of the fact that what I know means to be may mean something very different to 75% of the population. I'm only one, and I have one way of knowing, and there are four. And your comment about how could God just recognize one church, ask an Orthodox Jew. Ask an Islamist fundamentalist. They both have answers. So the real question, I think, and you've done a brilliant job of helping us understand it, you must doubt. By definition, if you are not doubting, you are not faithful. That's what I heard you say. Except from now on, I'm going to call it the spooky effect. I prefer that. But the essence, I think, of the message of faith is when the man in Mark says, "I believe, help thou mine unbelief." What he's saying is, it works for me, maybe. Help me make it work for me. And I'd like to know your opinion of whether I'm kind of off on some humanitarian kick, or that's consistent with people like Tillich and Niebuhr and the Germans.
I think that, if I understand your comment correctly, that this way of knowing is sort of embracing, a bit of the unbelief and the belief together at the same time in one of these definitions of Greek knowing. And no, I think that's absolutely part of what we have to come to accept and realize. It's just that we get so acclimated to hearing it in testimony meetings so many times. And if you don't feel it that way, you often feel like you're not part of the congregation.
But that requires a level of emotional maturity most of us never want to pay the price to achieve. And that's a very important sentence. I'm a clinical doodah, so... the maturity part is serious. It's very easy to say "I know" and hide. I think what you're inviting us to do is say "I know" and wonder. And I think that takes more emotional maturity.
Absolutely. It takes more maturity. You have to be willing to face up to things that you'd rather not realize and have to deal with. Let's go ahead and take your comment, Kim, and then we'll come up here.
Yeah, let me just propose another interpretation of I know X within the church. Within early Christianity, I believe that there was a sentence you said, which was your way of saying I'm Christian, and the sentence was Jesus is Lord. Okay. And within Mormonism, there's a sentence you say, which says I'm Mormon, and it is I know Joseph is a prophet. And people do get confused, and they think they know. I'll agree with that. And in a way that I would use the word know in a declarative, you know, assertion sense. But it's almost like a speech act rather than a report of a belief. Yes. In which you're saying, I signed up that I'm Mormon by saying these words. Rather than, I don't say those words because I use the word know much more carefully. But I think that's what a lot of people are doing.
Well, that ties back into the comment in the back of the room that you had. We had the comment of the idea as a catchphrase or as a code phrase for something else. And it could very well probably as part of that as well. That 99% of the people aren't thinking about things like that. That they're just sort of, you know, saying, I'm here, I accept it, I'm part of it. This, I say the magic words, poof. But we had one up here and then we'll go back here.
Yeah, it seems to me, and maybe you can confirm or unconfirm, that we might get that language, I know, from the Book of Mormon, because it really is full of speaking of knowing. That's, it seems
very,
like...
Very specific ways.
Yeah. And
very
yeah.
factual, very empirical, very practical.
Yeah, the Book of Mormon absolutely does say
so
that. We have that
seems,
in Moroni, we have that in
yeah.
Alma. Alma says, plant the seed
so
of faith.
It's just
Moroni
kind of
says,
all the stories and all the dramas, there's foreknowledge,
yeah.
there's God telling them very specific practical stuff.
And so it seems like we're taking that language.
We probably are cutting into the times of other Sunstone sessions, so we probably should dismiss everyone that wants to go. I think you're right that there are aspects of the knowing that are used in the Book of Mormon, but I think that it also says in the Book of Mormon that faith is not a knowledge. So it has that as well. Anybody who would like to stick around, I'd be happy to take questions. Those that need to go to the next session, just drop your email up here at the front, and I'll be happy to get this off to you.